It's The Unbelievable Truth with your host, David Mitchell.
Hello and welcome to The Unbelievable Truth, the panel show about incredible truths and barely credible lies. I'm David Mitchell. What a treat we've got tonight. Four of my favourite people ever are the founders of the SDP in 1981. Special shout out to Roy Jenkins. Still, that's neither here nor there. So please welcome tonight's panellists, Lucy Porter, Holly Walsh, Miles Jupp and Henning Vane. The rules are as follows. Each panellist will present a short lecture that should be entirely false, save for five hidden truths which their opponent should try to identify. Points are scored by truths that go unnoticed, while other panellists can win points if they spot a truth or lose points if they mistake a lie for a truth. First up is Holly Walsh. Holly, your subject is drugs. Chemical substances that have a physiological or psychological effect when ingested or otherwise introduced into the body. Off you go, Holly. Fingers on buzzers, the rest of you.
I am a lifelong square who has never taken drugs, but as...
You see.
I think you are a lifelong square, and I mean that in the nicest possible way.
Puts you in an interesting position.
Some wild things. I've run through a couple of hay fields.
And hay is a euphemism for
wheat.
Does she get a point?
No.
No. She has taken a lot of drugs. Okay.
That's
just
really
so we know.
That's basically a cry for help, Holly.
As a lifelong square who's never taken drugs, I'm going to take a load of drugs now so I can speak from experience. Got a kick to it. Right! Yes! Okay, facts. Who likes facts? I love facts. Okay. Without drugs, early Brits wouldn't have invented shops. When people got bored of foraging for magic mushrooms in their natural habitat of hard-to-reach areas like the top of the White Cliffs of Dover, the grounds of Buckingham Palace, or that little grassy bit in Leicester Square, a smart druid opened his... Oh, I'm so high. I couldn't even finish this. Woo! Okay.
Miles.
I think the top of the White Cliffs of Dover is quite good for mushrooms.
No. Apparently not.
Oh, God, I'm thinking of casual sex.
Sorry.
Carry on, Holly. Completely my mistake. Do continue.
Lucy.
Well, while we're here, I reckon there's mushrooms in the garden of Buckingham Palace. Well,
you're absolutely right.
Yes.
During the filming of ITV's 2014 miniseries, The Queen's Garden, Alan Titchmarsh discovered the psychedelic magic mushrooms known as Amanita muscaria while touring the 40-acre grounds of Buckingham Palace. The mushrooms are thought to have grown naturally rather than having been planted there. Holly.
Anyone want to share this needle? No, suit yourself. Buying things in person soon became too much hassle, so the internet was invented to sell drugs faster, hence eBay. Cannabis was the first ever thing sold online, whereas cocaine was the first thing ever sold in a line. Okay, I'm really coming up now. Okay, hang on. I've never done drugs.
You owe Lucy a point if that's true.
Dang. Queen Victoria bonded with a young Winston Churchill with a spot of cocaine, kicking off Churchill's long-lasting love of his own voice. And Simon and Garfunkel met at Narcotics Anonymous, but because they were anonymous, neither of them realised until 5 years later. I feel amazing. I could fight you all. Speaking of which... Famous drug smugglers include US Presidents Richard Nixon, George H.W. Bush, and Herbert Hoover, who had business cards saying Hoover by name, Hoover by nature. If you don't know a US president, you can buy official Unbelievable Truth cocaine from the BBC shop. But if you want to sound as cool as me while doing it, use one of the many street names for cocaine, like Bolivian Bicarb, Shouty Powder, Mary Berry's Self-Raising Sugar... The old nostril number, and of course, lady. And with that, I can now say the official line of the BBC is that drugs are great and you should all take them. I'm starting to come down now. Has anyone got any ice cream?
Thank you, Holly. So, Holly, at the end of that round, you've managed to smuggle four truths past the rest of the panel. Which are that the first item sold online was a bag of marijuana. In 1971, students at Stanford University completed what is considered to be the world's first online commercial transaction by purchasing a bag of marijuana from students at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology via ARPANET, the precursor to today's internet. The second truth is that Queen Victoria took cocaine with Winston Churchill. Yes, Queen Victoria was a huge fan of drugs, her two favourites being opium and cocaine. The former she consumed every morning in the form of laudanum. The cocaine she consumed in the form of a chewing gum sweet. And she liked it so much that it's reported that she even shared some with Winston Churchill and his family during a visit to Balmoral. The third truth is that in 1958, Richard Nixon, then vice president, unknowingly smuggled £3 of marijuana through US customs on behalf of jazz musician Louis Armstrong. According to his biographer, Roger Stone, Nixon ran into Armstrong, who the US State Department has previously made a goodwill ambassador for the United States, while Armstrong was in the customs queue at New York's Idlewild Airport, where Nixon insisted the legendary jazz musician skip the queue, declaring, "Ambassadors don't have to go through customs, and the Vice President of the United States will gladly carry your bags for you." In doing so, Nixon inadvertently smuggled £3 of marijuana through United States customs. Anyway, it wasn't the worst thing Nixon did. The fourth truth is that, according to the US Drug Enforcement Administration, or DEA, lady is a common street name for cocaine. And that means, Holly, you've scored 4 points. Cocaine and crack cocaine rejoice in the names Pearl, Toot, Moonrock, Cocoa Puffs, and Bazooka, as do Jamie Oliver's children. OK, we turn now to Henning Vane. Henning is from Germany, but he's been here over 20 years now, so I think we're stuck with him. Henning, your subject is hats or headwear, shaped coverings for the head worn for warmth, status, as fashion items, or as part of a uniform. Off you go, Henning.
Hats were invented by Jesus, who was a famous carpenter. The Jesus patent wooden hat could be flipped over to use as an emergency fishing boat for his friends on Lake Galilee, which is where we get the word boater. Other chivalrous hats worn by semi-religious figures include the uncanonized Peruvian saint Paddington Bear, who always wears a hat when swimming.
Lucy.
I think Paddington does always wear a hat when he's swimming.
He does always wear a hat when he's swimming.
Yeah, of course he does.
Says here, the character of Paddington Bear was largely inspired by writer Michael Bond's father. Bond described his father as, quote, a very polite man who always wore a hat. Even on holiday on the Isle of Wight, he would wade into the sea, keeping his hat on in case he encountered someone he knew and needed something to raise in greeting.
Now we're coming to something really interesting. Turkey was once plagued by an epidemic of Tommy Cooper impressions. And when Turkish authorities banned the fez, it led to the fez riots and underground fez smuggling.
Holly.
I mean, there's got to be something in that. You never see anyone wearing fezes anymore. They must have been banned somewhere.
You're absolutely right. Hey. Yes. The hat law, which was introduced in Turkey in 1925, prohibited the wearing of traditional headgear such as the fez and the turban, requiring instead the use of Western-style hats in public spaces. The ban sparked widespread riots and protests across the country, as well as a thriving fez-smuggling trade.
All civil unrest originates with hats and headgear. There were the Devon Beanie Beano of... The Devon...
Myers.
I don't know what he's saying, but it's definitely true.
Would you like to finish what you're saying?
Now, I was talking about the Devon Beanie Beano of 1956, which reduced Newton Abbott to rubble. In which state it largely remains today.
I'm afraid that's not true.
And who could forget, I ask, the 1922 straw hat riots in New York, in which anyone wearing a straw hat was at risk of being assaulted and having their heads destroyed. Talking of straw, men have always drawn the short straw when it comes to headgear. All the best men's headgear has been stolen by women, including scrunchies, rollers, tiaras, MAGA hats, and dealy boppers.
Lucy.
I feel like something in that list must be true. Like rollers, men used rollers before women did.
No.
Oh.
No, that was it was a woman's hat largely worn in the 1930s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In China, we haven't mentioned them yet. In China, men had to wear a green headscarf if their wives or female relatives had been putting it about. Today, unwrapping a lovely green beanie from your wife in China means Merry Christmas, darling, I'm the village bike.
Miles.
Well, they do have a lot of bikes in China, don't they? There's that pop song about it. Is that related in some way?
Well, maybe there is a green hat that symbolises...
Oh, yeah, let's say I buzz for that. Yeah.
What, the green... Well, you're right.
Thank you.
Yes. What is true is that in ancient China, hats were reserved for the upper class, commoners were obliged to wear headscarves, and men who had relatives who worked as prostitutes were obliged to wear green headscarves. Thus, it became common to insult men whose wives were unfaithful by describing them as, quote, wearing a green headscarf. Even today in modern China, wearing a green hat implies that a man's wife has been unfaithful.
Today, hats are at a crossroads.
I so hope that they ask you to do the wreath lectures this year. Because...
The true use of a hat since 1800 has been to tantalise the public while the wearer's hands are free to get up to no good, as can be seen with the Artful Dodger, Mr. Tickle, or any member of the clergy.
Thank you, Henning. And at the end of that round, Henning, you've managed to smuggle two truths past the rest of the panel, which are that there were straw hat riots in New York in 1922. In the early 20th century, men in New York traditionally wore straw hats during the summer months from the 15th of May till the 15th of September and felt hats in the colder months. Thus, September the 15th became known as Felt Hat Day, and failing to wear a felt hat on the day meant running the risk of having your straw hat knocked off and trampled by a prankster. However, what started as hijinks soon escalated when groups of youths attempted to seize hats off dock workers and other labourers, and these men resisted, sparking mass brawls throughout the city. And the second truth is that tiaras were originally worn by men, specifically Persian kings. And that means, Henning, you've scored 2 points. Next up is Lucy Porter. Lucy, your subject is the BBC, or British Broadcasting Corporation. Off you go, Lucy.
The BBC was invented in 1921 by the Daily Mail in order to give the paper's readers something to get angry about. The first television actors were paid less than radio actors because television only showed the actors in miniature, whereas on radio their voices were the same size as in real life.
Holly. I reckon TV actors were paid less than radio actors at the beginning.
You're absolutely right, yes. And one of the reasons given was that the actors were only shown in miniature.
Really?
Yes.
In the 1940s, the BBC explicitly forbade comedians from making jokes about washerwomen, birthday cake, trombone salesmen, railway carriages, or the Boer War. Most of the BBC's most popular and enduring fictional characters were based on real people. Labour politician Roy Hattersley provided the model for leading Womble Uncle Bulgaria, while the villainous Davros from Doctor Who was based on the philosopher Bertrand Russell, and Mussolini was reputedly the inspiration for Mr. Blobby.
Miles.
I think the Womble one.
Uncle Bulgaria was not based on Roy Hattersley, I'm afraid to say. Oh, Holly.
That's the Doctor Who one.
That is the right one, yes. Yeah. Actor Michael Wisher, who's cast in the role of Davros, has said he based his performance on the philosopher Bertrand Russell. Terry Nation, creator of the Dalek concept, deliberately modelled elements of the Dalek's character on Nazi ideology and conceived of their creator as a scientist with strong fascist tendencies.
I bet you're probably into Doctor Who, aren't you?
I was as a child.
Yes. Have you ever been asked to be in it?
I did a voice of a robot.
Because you sound like a Nazi.
No. I didn't do the voice of a Dalek. I was the voice of a centrist robot. But an interesting fact, Bertrand Russell was also the inspiration for Professor Yaffle.
Wow.
In Bagpuss.
Oh, really?
So
yeah.
Professor Yaffle and Davros, you can sort of see two sides to the man. They must have said his family. What sort of a day is he having? Yaffle or Davros? He won't come downstairs, must be Davros. He can't come downstairs. Whereas Yaffle was great on stairs. Hop down them, no problem.
The mascots for BBC Two when it was launched on the 20th of April 1964 were two kangaroos called Hullabaloo and Custard.
Miles.
Already I'm just collapsing with self-doubt. But Hullabaloo and Custard?
You're absolutely right.
Oh, yes.
Yes. Hullabaloo and Custard were the two mascot kangaroos used to launch BBC Two. Hullabaloo, the mother, represented BBC One, while Custard, the baby in her pouch, represented BBC Two. A live kangaroo was even brought to Television Centre for the opening night. However, disaster struck when a fire at Battersea Power Station caused a power cut across West London, resulting in the cancellation of the entire planned gala celebration. BBC presenter Gerald Priestland recalled, "Producers cursed, public relations men wept, Fleet Street cheered and jeered, and the kangaroo, stuck in a lift due to the power cut, went berserk." So there you go. I mean, chaos. They had to send in Attenborough to calm him down.
Like everyone else, I do sometimes wonder, why can't we get back to the good old days of the BBC, when all the announcers had to wear hats while they were presenting the news, when Scottish presenters were banned because they were deemed unintelligible to right-thinking people, and when Woman's Hour was presented by a man?
Thank you, Lucy. Oh, Miles?
Was Woman's Hour originally presented by a man?
You're absolutely right, it was, yeah. The first edition of Woman's Hour was presented by a man, Alan Iveme, who, according to the Radio Times, was a specialist, quote, in writing for and talking to women. So you can see why he got the job. Features in Iveme's Woman's Hour included cooking with whale meat, I married a lion tamer, and how to hang your husband's suit. However, these broadcasts were criticised for being patronising, and a female presenter, Mary Hill, replaced Iveme 3 months after the show's launch. And there was further controversy during Mary Hill's tenure when, in an item about women's health, the word vagina was used. Such was the uproar that for decades afterwards, the term birth canal was used instead. And that means, Lucy, that you have managed to smuggle one truth past the rest of the panel, which was, in the 1940s, comedians were forbidden from making jokes about the Boer War, saying it should be referred to as the South African War. And that means, Lucy, you've scored 1 point. It's now the turn of Miles Jupp. Your subject, Miles, is Germany, a Central European country... Perhaps best known for its cars, classical composers, philosophers, beer culture, highly efficient infrastructure, and its former genocidal and megalomaniacal regime. Off you go, Miles.
That set the tone nicely, David.
It was the German writer Goethe who remarked, "In German, we have no word for sorry, for which we must apologise, but we can't." Things the Germans have invented include germs, nudity, they have over 30 words for it, the mullet hairstyle, the world domination board game Risk, and the contraceptive pill, which they refer to as the Pillenbabystop.
Henning.
Lots of board games come from Germany. Is Risk one of them?
It isn't, I'm afraid.
Nah.
It was invented by a Frenchman, Albert Lamaurice, in 1957.
Well, that's ironic, isn't it?
Germans have always had the most forward-looking creative minds. Johannes Gutenberg applied to join his local library 5 years before inventing the printing press. And the 18th century German writer Friedrich Schiller was sent no fewer than 2 reminders to pay his TV license. Comedy was unheard of in Germany until... until the end of the Second World War, when, under the terms of the Potsdam Agreement, Clement Attlee's government sent over some of our finest British comedians in an attempt to cultivate a German sense of humour. Munich, Frankfurt and Cologne welcomed Max Miller, Arthur Askey and George Formby, respectively, while Nazi prisoners in Berlin's Spandau prison had to put up with Bernard Manning.
Holly.
That sounds soft power enough that they might have done that, sent out comedians to Germany.
And which comedian do you think they sent out?
George Formby.
I'm afraid that's not
right. I know for a fact Manning was in Berlin, wasn't he?
Are you going to venture a buzz?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
You're absolutely right.
But he's cheating. Yeah.
In his late teens, the comedian Bernard Manning worked as an armed guard watching over senior Nazis locked up in Berlin's Spandau prison. Manning recalled, "It was a bizarre experience standing over the likes of Rudolf Hess and Albert Speer with a Bren gun."
Crikey. And, yes, his opening line was, "What's the quickest way to Poland? Straight on, then Third Reich." Honk, honk. For all British people of my generation, the greatest German will always be Boris Becker. I personally was as thrilled to watch him unseeded in that 1985 Wimbledon final with Kevin Curran as I was to read about him unseeded in a restaurant broom cupboard with a Russian model. In fact, it's greatly to his credit that Playmobil's Boris Becker figurine remained the best-selling toy in Germany from 1986 right up until 2009, when Mattel launched its Angela Merkel Barbie doll.
Henning.
2009 was essentially the height of Angela Merkel's career, so did Mattel produce a figurine of her?
They absolutely did. Well done.
The German love of dogs is reflected in their word dogging. For example, in Germany, if I were to be discovered hobby dogging with a bunch of like-minded fellas in a remote car park or lay-by, it would simply mean we were out walking our invisible dogs.
Holly.
That's so insane, it must be true.
It is true. Yes, hobby dogging is a growing trend in Germany in which participants walk and train imaginary dogs. The craze was started in a small town.
I mean, hang on. When we say a growing trend, well, it used to be 3 people and now it's 5.
Well, I haven't got the figures. John, you've been a long time out of that country, Henry.
And if you think of how many litters those invisible dogs must have had in that time.
The craze was started in a small town in southern Germany by dog trainer Barbara Gerlinger, who now runs hobby dogging courses. Participants are encouraged to go on long dog walks and complete challenging obstacle courses with their imaginary pets. Gerlinger has even crafted her own line of leashes, reinforced with an internal wire, which are designed to give the impression of being pulled tight by an invisible dog.
She's a charlatan. Yeah.
She's an entrepreneur.
The German love of Christmas stems from the fact that Father Christmas, or St. Nikolaus, was actually German, and most English Christmas carols are actually translations or mistranslations from the German.
Henning.
Yeah, that's true. The Christmas carols.
No.
Yeah, of course. Oh, Tannenbaum, wie grün sind deine Blätter. Yeah. Du grünst nicht nur zur Sommerzeit, nein, auch im Winter, wenn es schneit. Oh, Tannenbaum, wie grün sind deine Blätter.
There's that one, and there's Silent Night, but that's Stille not most...
Stille Nacht, heilige Nacht, alle schläft einsam war.
Right, truce over. The truce is over.
Yes, come on, everyone, back to the trenches. Miles.
One such mistranslation concerns the German King Wenceslas, who, far from being good, was so evil that after one particularly disappointing meal, he ordered the chef to be roasted alive on a spit. When asked exactly how he wanted him roasted, Wenceslas replied, "Till he's crisp and even."
Polly.
I would love Wenceslas to be a baddie.
Well, you're right that the German king or emperor Wenceslas was a baddie.
Yes.
I think...
Why did they write a song about him?
The carol was about a different king who was supposedly nicer than that, but this is a 15th century German emperor, Wenceslas.
Is Wenceslas a common name in Germany?
No.
He was notorious for his ruthlessness, and in 1400, the prince electors of Cologne, Mainz, Trier and the Palatinate had him deposed because he was so unpleasant. Mm. And this was in the Middle
Once
Ages.
Once again, some unpleasant foreigner giving us a bad name.
Thank you, Miles. And at the end of that round, Miles, you've managed to smuggle one truth past the rest of the panel, which is that in 2008, the 18th century German poet Friedrich Schiller was sent a reminder to pay his TV license by the German Television Licensing Agency. It was using the address of a primary school that was named after him. The school's head teacher contacted the agency, informing him that since Schiller died in 1805, he was, quote, not in a position to watch television or listen to radio. Despite this, a second reminder was sent, stating that Schiller would not have to pay if he could personally prove that he was not in a position to watch television or listen to radio. They subsequently issued an apology and blamed a computer error. And that means, Miles, you've scored 1 point. Which brings us to the final scores. In joint second place, with minus 1 point each, it's Henning Vane, Lucy Porter and Miles Jupp. And in first place with an unassailable 8 points, it's this week's winner, Holly Walsh. That's about it for this week. Goodbye.
The Unbelievable Truth was devised by John Naismith and Graham Garden and featured David Mitchell in the chair with panellists Miles Jupp, Lucy Porter, Holly Walsh and Henning Vane. The chairman's script was written by Dan Gaster and Colin Swash, and the producer was John Naismith. It was a random production for BBC Radio 4.